The Voice of America presents Focus. If you think that this Buddhist chant was recorded in some remote Himalayan monastery, think again. These Buddhist monks are playing to capacity crowds in a Christian cathedral in New York City, the heart of the secular West. Helen Tworkov, the editor of the popular Buddhist magazine, Tricycle, is heartened but not terribly surprised at the growing popularity of Buddhism in America.
Part of that is because it has this extraordinary flexibility and non-dogmatism. And so it doesn't contradict anything. It doesn't contradict science. It doesn't contradict computer technology. It doesn't contradict medicine. It doesn't come into opposition. And that's one of its great fortes, and that's one of the reasons we see it moving through culture so easily and without violence. It draws heavily on self-reliance, on independence, on personal experience. These are all the sort of most cherished ideals of America.
In this Focus report, Jessica Berman examines the ways that this quiet and subtle Asian religion is being recast in red, white, and blue by its up to 1 million American adherents, and explores how basic American cultural values are enhanced and in some cases transcended in the process.
From the mountains of Tibet to the plains of the American Midwest, no one likes to suffer. Unfortunately, everybody does, at least until they get smart. This was the Buddha's fundamental insight in India almost 2,500 years ago. The man who became the Buddha was born a prince. His parents did all they could to shelter him from the realities of decline, death, and decay. However, on a pleasure trip away from his palace, the sheltered aristocrat saw an old man, a sick man, and a corpse. His simple perception that life means change and suffering was the first of what Buddhists call the Great Four Noble Truths. Here is Allen Ginsberg, the famous American poet and a longtime Buddhist, on the simple truth of suffering.
Being born, we have this flesh and bones, and you can get cancer or old age, or teeth fall out, or hair fall out, or get caught in a snowstorm, or slip on the ice. So there's going to be some bodily and mental suffering.
The Buddha was so shaken by the reality of impermanence that he renounced his royalty and set off to discover for himself what the roots of suffering are and how to extinguish suffering through a state of wisdom and bliss called nirvana. This idea spread through Asia to China, Tibet, and Japan, and came to the United States in the last century. The Buddha's can-do attitude of self-reliance can be very inspiring to Americans who are exposed to his teachings. David Phillips is a lawyer in San Francisco.
The Buddha sat down under the tree, under the famous Bo tree, and he said, "I'm not moving from here until I have achieved nirvana," and he didn't. And he told everyone, "You can do it too. So get busy."
The Buddha's second noble truth is that people suffer because of attachment. In our desire to get what we want, we suffer. In our desire to avoid what we don't want, we suffer. Even if we get what we think we want, we suffer in the fear that we may lose it. And we always ultimately do. Like Alice in Wonderland, we are running as hard as we can to stay in the same place. Rick Fields is the author of When the Swans Came to the Lake, A History of Buddhism in America. He applies the Buddha's insight to society's modern predicament.
Everything around us is conspiring to speed us up, you know, and it really sometimes seems as if the machines are running our lives. You know, you have answering machines, you have faxes, you have, now you have everybody's walking around with cellular phones, so, you know, and people's, you know, and the idea seems to be to get as much done as possible. Machines, that's what they do good, you know, machines move very fast and computers move very fast. Human beings, I have a feeling, are not meant to do that. It really robs us of our birthright.
Kate Wheeler is an American who was once a Buddhist nun in Burma. She is the author of the aptly titled book, Not Where I Started From.
The problem is if you have an ordinary life and you carry around the idea that you should be somewhere else, then it's bad for you and it's bad for the people around you. I mean, Buddhism looks at that directly and says what we need to do is learn how to be a little more at ease with the way things really are, rather than trying to always chase an image of how we wish things would be.
Americans can be doubly vulnerable to the suffering born of material desire. Not only do they have the natural human acquisitiveness, they live in an intensely commercial culture whose bounty gives the impression that their cravings can ultimately be satisfied. Every commercial bears the same basic message that says, you may not know it, but what you have is not enough, and therefore you are not good enough. But buy this product and then you'll be happy. According to Helen Torkoff, this is as un-Buddhist an attitude as one might have.
In Buddhism, we have the idea of original enlightenment. We're not trying to get something that we don't already have. We have all the equipment that we need to understand life completely. This is the Buddhist teachings. You know, most of the time we're walking around and we're so tyrannized by our emotional and sensory life, you know, that our minds tend to control our lives, that what we think about and how we think about it and how we perceive reality tends to kind of have our head in a knot. It's like we're walking around with our head in some kind of a bench press all the time. And if you can get a little bit more relaxed and get some distance and give yourself some breathing space and start to see things a little bit differently, then I think you can kind of lighten up.
As the Buddha sat under his tree, he became aware of a third truth, one which can appeal to goal-oriented Americans. By calmly resisting the mind's temptation to grasp whatever the world and the mind itself offer up, we can unknot our confusion, end our suffering, and breathe free. This mental refocusing is called meditation. David Phillips explains what meditation means for him.
It's a way of learning to see the mind as separate from yourself. The Buddhists have a meditation where you comment internally on the quality of your mind. You say, turbulent mind, quiet mind, happy mind, bummed out mind. And you do this enough and you begin to see your mind operating as a kind of an independent entity. They speak of it as a drunken monkey. You know, if you try to control your thoughts for just a few seconds, it is astounding how difficult that is to do. Your mind just runs around on its own. And Buddhism has helped me, first of all, to recognize that process and then to try to get a handle on it. And when I feel myself, for example, angry when somebody does something I don't like, I'm able to realize that it's my wish that it be otherwise that's causing the turbulence in my mind. You got to pay attention. This was the Buddha's basic plea to everybody he saw. The only way you can free yourself from conditioning is to pay attention. And paying attention takes effort. And if you keep working at it and keep paying attention, you'll grow wise.
So-called right attention and right effort are two aspects of Buddha's final truth, which is called the Noble Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path also includes right understanding, right purpose, right action, right speech, right livelihood, and right meditation. Together, they form a weave that is the Buddhist prescription for self-liberation. Joseph Goldstein, the founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, often teaches the Buddhist meditative attitude toward right speech. Here in America, it is often fashionable to express one's feelings and let it all hang out without restraint, especially in personal relationships. Mr. Goldstein says that this is not the Buddhist way.
We do have this strong conditioning to quite automatically speak whatever is in our mind. But not everything in our mind is worth speaking about. You know, when I'm aware enough, when I'm mindful enough, I'll see very often that what I want to say is completely useless. It doesn't have any purpose at all. It's just a kind of impulse that arises. You know, even though the talk had not been particularly malicious, still it had been agitating for the mind. And so to work on this very simple level in an activity that we do every day, had immense impact, you know, on the quality of my life and inner experience. And I think it's quite instructive that in our culture there's not a lot of value given to silence and not a lot of opportunity for people to have that experience. But once we have a taste of it, it's really, silence is a fantastically beautiful thing.
The greatest and most fearsome silence of all, of course, is death, especially in America, where eternal youth is often the ideal, and any thoughts of age and death are suppressed. Since death is a fact and visits everyone sooner or later, it is the Buddhist view that it should be contemplated with open eyes, and an immense literature has grown up about it. Sogyal Rinpoche is a Tibetan Buddhist teacher who has written an anecdotal English translation of a classic Buddhist text on dying and death. It has sold over 100,000 copies in the United States alone.
In the kind of modern life, you see, like in America, we're not taught to look at life and death as a whole. So death is seen in isolation. This means we become very attached to this life and reject and deny death. So we are very much, as you said, obsessed with youth and abandon the elderly to a lonely death. And because they remind us of death, we treat, sometimes shamefully, those suffering from the terminal illnesses such as AIDS. So death becomes our ultimate fear, the last thing that we want to look at. Beneath the fear of looking into death lies actually the fear of looking into and facing ourselves. So if we do so, we might discover who we really are and discover the nature of mind, which is like the sky and embraces the whole of life and death.
Meditation makes a difference. This comes as a refreshing surprise to Americans who were raised to believe that spiritual realization can take place only in heaven. Professor Roger Kamenetz of Louisiana State University is the author of The Jew in the Lotus. He discusses Buddhism's pragmatic appeal for Americans.
I don't think Americans like being told, you know, you have to accept this on our authority. We believe in testing something to see if it's true. And Buddhism fits in very well with that. I mean, the Buddha said, you know, basically, try this, and if it works for you, fine. You don't have to sign up for a particular belief. You can just, if you want to do breathing meditation, the basic requirement is that you know how to breathe. I think Buddhism increasingly appeals to that spirit of experiment and direct experience.
One religious tradition in America is reflected in the idea that one can be spiritually responsible even if it contradicts established religious tradition and other modes of thought. Allen Ginsberg and his now-famous circle of beat poets were expressing this attitude when they became interested in Buddhism and its teachings during the conformist 50s. In Buddhism and in art, the beat sought out what is called spontaneous mind.
Buddhists don't claim Buddha to be a god. They just say he's a guy that meditated and found his own nature and began teaching. And the teaching is, rather than God, is the teaching of that reality is real, but at the same time it's empty in the sense that it's transitory. So that's the key. There's no permanent me. Even that is kind of flowing. Once you understand those terms, then you begin to appreciate the beauty of existence as it is, transitory and temporary as it is, like a rainbow in the sky, or like a bubble, or like a fleeting dream, so that actually things are quite free and open. It isn't, you know, given from the outside. It's something that we make ourselves as a mass or community imagination. And that's where the poet comes in and the artist comes in. Because the artists have always felt that it was a quality of life and the interrelation of person and soul or feeling or sensitivity that made life worthwhile rather than merely piling up kingdoms and skyscrapers. Any means of communication, and it's not just words and it's not just preaching and it's not just sitting either, because there has to be meditation in action also. You know, your activity has to show the equanimity, calm, open-mindedness, and freedom, and playfulness, and compassion of what you've learned, and you have to demonstrate that. And art is a good way of communicating that.
Gary Snyder, a poet colleague of Allen Ginsberg, agrees that sitting in meditation sets the tone for a fully Buddhist life, but also stresses that awakening also comes from acting in the everyday world in ways that promote wisdom and compassion. Mr. Snyder says that the world is constantly offering its lessons to those who are detached and watchful while they work and play.
Well, what is work? not so far different from play. It's what we do in a daily way to sustain ourselves, in all the ways that we sustain ourselves. And we all must do it. And it is a constant teacher to us, because we learn by doing. And we can't back off from work. We would become attenuated if we did. Furthermore, we're all connected to to each other and to the world. We all need to take responsibility for our own material life on the planet to some degree. So work is almost a primary sacrament of living. At the heart of that, if we enter into it, is this wonderful perception of the nature of matter and the nature of energy. And to sit in that perception with clarity is real Buddhist practice.
For many Americans and others, the hardest work we must do day to day is with our spouses. It therefore comes as no surprise that some American Buddhists are turning marriage itself into a path to final freedom. Hilary Vartanian and Jim Hurley are a busy young professional couple in California. Although both were raised as Christians, they decided a Buddhist wedding ceremony was the best way to express their new bond. Their promises to each other were the same as the ones Buddhist priests utter when they renew their own commitments. They explain their unusual choice.
There was a lot of what we perceive to be truth, essential value, in the exchange of commitments that the Buddhist ceremony expresses. It talks about a sanctity for life, the understanding of an interrelationship that we all share to nature and ourselves. And also it expresses, in some ways, technical approaches that you can use to find that sort of inner peace and inner truth.
I know now that what I do with Jim in terms of my marriage is a conscious practice in terms of living with Buddhist ideals. It has to do with truth, it has to do with humility, it has to do with honesty. And we can't run from the things that we may choose to hide from. Instead, we have to face them head on to really be conscious in our practice of our marriage. Keeping open to the vulnerability and the honesty that comes with true exchange.
Buddhist practice helped the couple come to respectful common understanding when their opinions differed concerning their finances, a situation that often creates demoralizing conflicts in American marriages.
We both had to do a lot of give and take, and we had to remind each other of what our commitments were. I mean, we would actually remind each other. Remember, you said that you wouldn't criticize mindlessly, or you would tell me that you'd respect me and you'd deal with humility towards me if we found our tempers flaring or something like that. So we actually reflected on our vows during this discussion.
Not that relations between the sexes are always or even usually ideal in the Buddhist world in America. American Buddhism grew out of an Asian cultural context that often viewed women in a subservient role. Kate Wheeler, for one, is fighting bravely to overhaul these traditions to reflect her feminist beliefs. Still, despite the historic inequities, Ms. Wheeler feels that Buddhism and democracy are connected in the heart.
In any democracy, that we grow up with some sense of everybody being equal, even if that's not even perfectly practiced, that everyone can make a choice about their life. People do get to decide pretty much what our values are going to be and what we choose to make valuable in our lives. In Buddhism, there's the idea that every being can become enlightened, and every being has the seeds of wisdom in themselves. Every conscious and living creature can become perfect, and that's very much related. I like to think of both the Buddhist and the democratic ideal together. It's just another kind of awakening.
You have been listening to Focus on the Voice of America. This program on the increasing appeal of Buddhism in America was written by Adam Phillips and narrated by Jessica Berman. Focus was produced by Tom Sargent and directed by Felicia Butler.